Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by the 2013 Hyundai Elantra. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
This is Autoline After Hours with Peter DiLorenzo, episode 206 for Thursday, August 8th, 2013. Electric Slide.
Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Well, hello there. I'm Peter DiLorenzo, the Auto Extremist, and we're coming to you live in beautiful downtown Farmington Hills, somewhere in Michigan. Another episode of Autoline After Hours, and joining me, Mr. Gary Vasilash from Automotive Design and Production. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you, Peter.
Mr. Todd Lassa from Automobile.
Hello,
always
Peter.
Great to have you, Todd. And the one and only Jim Hall, the man who knew too much, from 2953 Analytics, and also the increasingly popular Design Handbook.
I thank the people that watch it. It's lots of fun to do, and hopefully we are imbuing some sort of information.
Yes.
With entertainment.
Yes. So, there's, once again, a few things to discuss this week. Gary was up in Traverse City. None of us other guys were. So I'm going to ask Gary to just give some highlights that he perceived while he was up there, if there were any.
So I wasn't up there for the film festival. So
Let's
let our audience know that
the two-headed shark was one of the things they had at the film festival.
You were up there for the management.
The Center for Automotive Research Management Briefing Seminar, the 48th annual.
Yes.
48th? 48th annual. Can you imagine that?
I can't imagine people that have been golfing that long that are still alive.
And briefing's a bit of a misnomer. It goes on for several days. And
yes.
A lot of cocktails.
A lot of stuff going on.
And and this is the first year that Dave Cole didn't go up there.
Wow.
So what this is essentially set up where initially for suppliers to talk to suppliers, and that became the venue for the OEMs to talk to suppliers.
When that became a big issue.
So now it's sort of a mixture between supplier executives talking to other suppliers and OEM executives talking to other OEM executives and suppliers and so on and so forth. And there are sessions all day long. And I'll tell you, I was astonished that usually the first couple days of that program are just vacant, that no one shows up, because it's always tactical the first part of the week and then strategic the second part of the week. And so Wednesday is always the big day because all the big executives come. Well, for one thing, there weren't really a whole lot of big executives this year.
There were politicians.
There were always politicians.
Yeah.
But the thing was that they had a record-breaking attendance on Monday. That the place was completely jammed. And you can look at it from the point of view of, gee whiz, the auto industry is back, because this thing is held at a resort in Traverse City. And if you've not been to Traverse City, it's a beautiful place up there.
It's a pseudo golf outing too.
Yeah, but the thing was that again, ordinarily after lunch,
it's like, vacant.
The place vacant.
Yeah,
still full. And you know, so it's either the auto industry is back, and therefore people can actually go travel up there and spend a few days, or the other thing is that there are such pressures now on these guys in the industry, and they all are facing such big challenges and changes in the whole way things are working that they actually need to be there to learn stuff.
To network and commiserate and find out what other guys are doing.
It came down to a lot of the discussion was focused in one way or another on CAFE in terms of how they're going to meet it. So there's a lot of discussion of powertrain, a lot of discussion of different materials, a lot of discussion of autonomous driving. It was very, very interesting and somewhat surprising. They had a speaker from Cisco. And ordinarily, they sometimes have somebody from out of the industry who, you know, who flies in from the West Coast and makes a presentation. This guy is talking about the Internet of Everything, mm-hmm. but was talking about it in the context of cars. I mean, this guy was...
They're automotive internet guys. Yeah.
Steeped in the auto industry.
Well, and Cisco announced an agreement or a deal with Continental, and I don't remember all the details or didn't read all the details, but having to do with cars talking to each other.
Sure, so it's V2V, vehicle-to-vehicle
right,
communication.
Exactly. Which is also going on in Ann Arbor. There's
which has got to be a standard for this thing to get pulled off.
Right.
And therein lies one of the problems, because there's still companies that think they can figure out better ways to do it.
Yeah, and then it was sort of an interesting thing that there was a discussion of, okay, who makes this decision and when do they make it? So Chris Baroni-Bird, who was formerly with General Motors, now works for Qualcomm, which is a surprise.
I thought you knew he had been at Qualcomm. That was where he...
Yeah, he'd gone over there, yeah. But he made a presentation that was interesting to hear what he was talking about. And see, but the problem with this whole V2V thing is that, you know, there's a whole lot of cars out there that are not new cars that would not have that technology. And so how do you get that technology out there? And he was making a suggestion that what you might do is embed it in cell phones, because mm-hmm. everyone has a cell phone. And so if you had this short-range communication system that's coming out of your cell phone, if you had that in your car, you'd be able to do it that way.
Well, it also gets to the problem, I think, with modern, I hate to call them infotainment, I hate that word, so I'll call them information entertainment systems in the center dash of your car. All the luxury models are still, you know, embedding everything in the dash, the navigation and the radio and so on. And some of the lower end models at General Motors, for example, at the Chevy Spark and Sonic, will have you use your own mobile phone.
Well, that's the future for all these systems. The future for all these systems is that the cars are basically device agnostic.
Right.
And they pick up what they need from your phone. And the guys that are going to figure out the best way to do it are going to be guys that have, when you get in the car, it's the interface you're used to. It's not their interface.
And I know that Ford and Cadillac and everybody and Audi and BMW have spent so much money on those
interfaces.
Systems. Cool. But the company that switches over to that more quickly, I think, will have
it's harder than you think.
I know it's not easy.
It necessitates, for one thing, from what I've been told,
it is possible, but to
get all the info you want, if you actually want to read the interface in the car, you have to have the next generation of Bluetooth in it because of the bandwidth that's required to keep this thing talking all the time and what you're going to be transferring. See that?
Yeah, it is hard.
Ta-da!
So try to hold on to your phone, yeah.
So what stood out? Gary, anything?
Well, I mean, I thought a couple of things stood out. One was a presentation made by a supplier, Ted Dukholz of Freudenberg and OK. And you're like, Freudenberg and OK, who the hell's ever heard of them? And basically the guy makes seals. But the thing his speech was basically predicated on was he was talking about sustainability, but sustainability in a different way. And basically it came down to the fact that Ted was saying there needs to be what you would call true believers in the industry, and that is a problem with the auto industry as he sees it right now. He's suggesting that there aren't a sufficient number of people who are committed to go outside and go beyond and go above and to really create good product, that there's a general culture that there seems to be people that are more reticent to do that. And he's saying, you know, you can't sustain the industry if you just have people who are, you know, busy, you know, looking at their own areas. And so I thought that was rather phenomenal to hear. And,
well, the design community does that as a matter of course. And parts of engineering, but he's right. A lot of...
It's too insular. It's like the company that's trying to make the perfect fill-in-the-blank, so they keep talking to the customers about how to make it better and better and better, and they've completely lost track of the context of the entire automobile. But boy, they got a cup holder that their last 9 users love.
Yeah, so you're basically talking about the good old not invented here syndrome,
sure.
Basically.
When I first started out at Extremis, I joked, but not really, that if I ran one of the car companies, I'd pick all the top executives, like the top 50 executives, and go to a town where the automobile business doesn't even make the front page of the business page. It might be like page 8, if that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, camp at a hotel there, go out to the dealers, just spend time in an environment where the car is like, yeah, whatever.
Their problem, and to be a little bit of a devil's advocate on this, because it's the type of thing that critics like us will criticize them for. The other criticism is, be true to your brand. Are you being true to your brand? So how do you balance that? How do you be true to the brand and yet go outside of the brand to determine?
But therein lies probably one of the biggest problems. That
exactly.
The awareness of what these brands are is illusory at best.
Yeah.
The brands, in a lot of cases, at some major car companies, have turned into a series of checkboxes. That's what the brand is. The brand, if we got this, that we're that vehicle. And it's two or three cues, and that's it. And that's not what branding is about.
Well, let's take a brand like BMW, which, you know, which already changed when it went from being the enthusiast's brand, at least in this country, in the late 60s through the 70s, to being the so-called yuppie car of the 80s, and they still build cars that are, you know, engaging and fun to drive, but they also have to
appeal to the people that don't give a rat's ass.
Move the technology so that you have, you know, e-pass steering instead of belt-driven power steering or pump-driven power steering, which opens its own set of problems. And you also getting back to this whole thing of having a big screen in the center dash. I mean, you know, I don't care about that. I'd rather have a car without all that stuff. All I need is a radio.
Yeah, but you're such an outlier.
Well, I know.
You absolutely, Todd rejects the new technology.
Oh, you love to. I just gave you the biggest opening on that ever. But I mean, you know, the opposite of that is having cars drive themselves so people can talk on their phones. And in my new commute to Ann Arbor since I've joined Automobile Magazine, you know, I've become far more aware of that than I was even before. And believe me, I was pretty aware of that before and just how insidious it has become.
Oh, yeah. So you don't talk on your phone when you're driving to Ann Arbor?
I try not to. I very seldom do.
But, I mean, I guess the question becomes for some of these companies, what they are, whether they're boxes they check off. And it seems like, you know, that BMW now is changing itself from being the enthusiast car to being the technology company.
Well,
that trying to push that.
All I know is they've got the 4 Series on the website now. And you go look at the 4 Series, and it's like, yeah, it's nice. It's not really as nice as the last one. And each BMW has a little bit less of what enthusiasts think of BMWs as being. And each one, a little bit, it's a little bit, it's the death of a thousand cuts, which happened to Chevrolet.
Yeah, well, don't forget that the German car company's ultimate downfall will be the fact that they're greedy, the most greedy car companies in the world. And the only way they can make more money is to investigate more niches. They want to, you know, BMW wants a BMW in every garage, and they will invent something if they have to. And Mercedes is like that, too, and you're absolutely right. You do that enough, and they're going to wake up, and no one's going to remember what a BMW was.
And exclusivity we can all own, right?
Yeah, and look at Porsche. I mean, you know, the argument is, you know, they sell Cayennes and Panameras so that the enthusiasts can still get the Cayman S and the 911 and the Boxster S. The problem with that is ultimately, if you sell enough Cayennes, which they are now, you're going to have like a generation of people whose only experience with Porsche is a Cayenne. They don't know what a...
There's no connection to the other car.
There's no connection. So now Porsche will come back and say, yes, but we're going to Le Mans in 2014 and we're going to remind everyone who we are and why we do things the way that we do. That's cool for the enthusiasts.
Yeah, but driving over here today, I saw a very interesting color I'd never seen on a Cayenne. Blue-gray went by, and there's a woman on her phone driving it. And in so many ways, she's not who I would expect someone to say, wow, I want to... And it was a Turbo S, okay? It's a very interesting car. But more and more people that aren't Porsche enthusiasts are going to buy Porsches, and they'll be a successful company, but...
Eventually, you lose...
The reason that you're even doing that.
The reason for being. And well, like you said, the Cayenne isn't a Porsche.
I know I was being idealistic, but a few years ago, I liked to think that as Volkswagen was absorbing Porsche...
Or vice versa, right?
That
didn't work out so well.
That had happened before the Cayenne, before the Panamera, that Porsche wouldn't have to do those cars. And, of course, now you look at the fact that, you know, Bentley and Rolls-Royce and whoever else are doing...
Macan, right. The small crossover.
Well, no, I'm talking about all the other companies that wouldn't have to do sport utilities because,
They do have to do it.
Well, they want to do it because
they have to do
more
it.
Profit.
Because the way the luxury market at the high end is morphing into this horrible mutant. It really is. It's like the mutant in the end of the Lost Skeleton of Kadavra, where it looks like it's a cross between a carrot and a bad actor. that's actually happening to the luxury car market now in a terrifying way because all but a few companies have lost track of what luxury genuinely is.
So what segment actually isn't morphing into crossovers or SUVs? I mean, it seems like they all are going in that direction.
True sports cars.
Yeah, true sports cars. But the problem is, I really do believe this, is if they play in this direction long enough and with more products, eventually there will be people at the company who don't know.
Oh, no argument.
What they were. I don't care how many tours they go through their own museums, they will forget. Look at all the glorious machines Mercedes has in their museum, all those wonderful race cars. And look at all the crap they're putting out, or half of it anyway. So
here's what's going to happen. An exec is going to be going through the old-timer collection. He's going to be, why in the world did we make this?
Yeah.
Okay. And he's going to be a guy from Porsche looking at a 911.
And, you know, and then...
But maybe that's because the company becomes redefined as being something else, right?
See, I have no doubt that's what's going to happen. And the thing is, to a lot of people, it won't make any difference. The truth is, if you look at the luxury market right now, that the majority of luxury cars, and this is a phrase that's being used, I mean, there's near luxury, you know, there's near premium, okay, there's near, mm-hmm. there's also now this new near mid-range car. These are all nears. Everything is near. You're not quite there. But you look at the luxury car market, and tell me what elements of luxury are in a 5 Series BMW that's a luxury element. Oh, leather seats? Well, no, you can get that in almost anything.
Better leather is what it comes down to. But
that's
to
my
your
point. It's not luxury.
Exactly.
It's nothing more than a grading thing of materials because luxury has deteriorated for most car companies into basically a checkbox affair.
Well,
it actually is. It's a matrix.
Then the question is, you know, and we've spoken about this, are brand new cars becoming a luxury? And you've got Ford with its... titanium.
But no. Not are they becoming a luxury. Are brand new cars being priced like luxury cars and don't carry anything other than the checkbox trappings? That's
right.
My point.
Yeah.
Well, they've set a trap for themselves, and the trap is two words: near luxury.
Of course,
it has absolutely destroyed the market. Now, you know, there's a phrase: democratization of technology. Well, now there's a democratization of just about everything.
Mm-hmm. I mean, see, one of the problems is that for some companies, they perceive technology as being a luxury item. And it's physically impossible because it is going to trickle down.
Well, look at the way they're repositioning Infiniti. You know, I mean, well, actually, whenever I get a release now from you name the company, they all sound the same. They're all, well, we're going to strive for a new level of luxury, a more personal luxury, this and a that. You know,
what was it—the Q30 concept that?
Yeah, they just showed it today.
And you know, but this is
looked like every drawing of anything
that you've
like
ever seen with an Infiniti front end,
right?
And the window line has a goofy window line,
and it's for
the
young
kink, I call it,
the young buyer, the young luxury buyer. Yeah. I mean.
Well, nobody's going after those old luxury buyers.
Yeah, right, and the old luxury buyers are the ones with the money.
The companies that are going after the old luxury car buyers that are actually there, their market, are the guys that build true luxury cars still.
Yeah. So what happens if and when the big crossover goes away as a luxury vehicle? What happens if in a few years, because of whatever reason...
No, it doesn't go away as a luxury vehicle. It becomes a co-definer of a luxury product.
I mean, what if that no longer is... popular for whatever reason, you know, in the same way that big body on frame American sport utilities are no longer.
Well, for one thing, the car will morph into something else because what we're seeing are morphed vehicles anyway.
No,
this
but
is an evolution.
The question, though, then is what happens to brands like Porsche and other brands that are about to get into that segment that are morphing from their brand identity into, you know, we do Cayennes and so on.
Well, Porsche is convinced that they will press the reset button next June and remind everyone who they are. Now, this will come on the heels of the introduction of the Macan,
yep.
which Porsche insiders are already putting the word out that dynamically it's sensational, mm-hmm. that it is... It's a crossover in name, but they have done magic with it.
It doesn't drive like a crossover.
Yes.
So we'll see.
So will the lady who was on her cell phone buy that car?
She'll buy it, but she won't know why it's... She'll never know what it can do. But that's true for a lot of luxury cars, sports car buyers. Yeah. They don't know what the cars can do.
That's true for 95% of the sports cars sold in this country.
The people that buy luxury and buy these things are buying branding. The majority of Corvette buyers, in a lot of cases now, are buying Corvette branding.
Yes. So now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some other things.
The Autoline brand.
Yes. So, Ben, let's roll that break from our friends at Bridgestone.
There's only one car company in America that's never made a single car. And while you won't find Firestone cars on any showroom floor, they're out there, running better, faster, stronger, longer. No, we don't build cars. But make no mistake, Firestone is a car company. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
It's time again for the biggest movable feast of metal, that is. It's the Woodward Avenue Dream Cruise. Join John McElroy, along with a million of his closest friends and eight lanes of classic cars, all coming to you on Friday, August 16th at 4 p.m. Eastern. It's the 2013 edition of Autoline Live from Woodward, sponsored by Chrysler, where hot rods are welcome.
There's a couple things. GM joined its electric car competitors this week by cutting the price of the Volt by $5,000. What do you guys think it'll take for the electric car movement to really to become more than a motoring sideshow that's only popular in the politically correct enclaves of Washington, D.C. and Northern California?
Well, just like any new technology, the price has to come down, obviously, and the longer you build it, the more the price comes down. It strikes me that the Chevy Volt now, without any kind of incentives at a base price of about $35,000 is just a few thousand dollars more than people paid for 2004 Toyota Priuses when it came out, and they were paying above sticker price because that was popular.
And the Volt is still eligible for the $7,500 credit.
And it's still eligible for that. Once it gets down, once you can do a car like that, that can be in the what in current dollars would be the $20,000 to $25,000 range, and maybe have that as a second car, as a car that you primarily drive to and from work. It makes a lot of sense.
There's another thing too. You need infrastructure.
Yeah.
And you need to have a charging system that will charge quickly without basically incinerating or destroying the battery. That it's that combination, and that's an interesting challenge technologically, because that means you do have to play with battery chemistry. You also have to look at things like how physically do you charge the battery, pulse charging, intermediate charging, this thing where you basically trickle high in. There are all sorts of ways of doing it. The interesting thing is that the infrastructure for Tesla owners in California is existent. You can drive a Tesla without virtually no pain from L.A. to San Francisco in a normal drive. If you stop at, like, I think it's in Coalinga, which the car will go that far usually easily, charge there with the 300-mile-per-hour charger. You know about that. Their supercharger will charge 300 miles of range in an hour. So you have lunch at the Harris Ranch or something, and your car's charged, you're ready to go. But without the infrastructure along with the cost, these things are going to be basically enclave vehicles, where there'll be little areas where the vehicles sell.
Yeah, well, back to the aforementioned Qualcomm, they have this inductive charging system that they're talking about doing, so you wouldn't plug the car in. You'd actually be charging it from pads that would be placed in the pavement, so you could have parking spots that would be usable by anyone.
Right.
It was funny, up in Traverse City, trying to find a parking place in front of the hotel was virtually impossible, and there were several empty spots. And they were not for handicapped parking. They were for electric vehicles. And they were empty.
But the point is, the inductive charging, all this stuff is great. But it necessitates an investment, an infrastructure investment, usually on the part of a municipality or a county or a state.
Oh,
and
sure.
The way incomes are for states, municipalities, and counties, that isn't going to happen. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. When I say infrastructure, we're talking about private infrastructure here is the only way it's going to get bump started. Because if we wait for it to be done by the state or the government, it won't happen.
Well, and that's why Musk has set up the superchargers
right.
himself, and he's doing that. But, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if you were there, but they had the Smart E Drive in Ann Arbor.
No, I missed that.
And so they're taking the approach whereby you buy what they're calling a glider, meaning car without a battery. Mm-hmm. And what you do is you are leasing the battery from them. They take full responsibility for that battery.
One of the EVs that Renault makes does the same thing, but they're hooked up with Better Place.
Well, the most interesting car
that's such a good place
that happens to have electric attached to it that I've read about is the BMW i3. Why? Because it weighs 2,700 pounds in pure electric mode without the engine.
But with the battery pack.
Yeah, with the battery pack. Now, the question is, BMW is insisting that it will drive like a BMW. Well, it's got the light weight. I'll grant them that.
Rear-wheel drive.
It's rear-wheel drive. If it drives like a reincarnation of a 2002, only better, they might have something, but... Yeah, generally, the electric vehicle...
It does have a little bit of that scientific potato look, though.
So I guess the question is, does it steer with a battery, huh? Being rear drive. But did anybody listen to Musk, Tesla's...
I was just going to ask about Tesla because, you know, the media praise, the stock price, you know, and you read further into the numbers and they still have some major issues with financial issues. So what do you think? Where is Tesla going?
Well, it's interesting because the next thing they're doing, of course, is the Model X, which is a body stealth variant of the Model S. So it's not like building a second new car. I have no doubt they're going to hit their target for 25% for the fourth quarter. I have no doubt. I have no doubt they're going to deliver 21,000 cars or more this year. When they start selling in Asia, that has some potential for some higher volume, too. They're going to get their volume up. The company, if it continues to become successful, even at a lower rate than it has been, then by 2016, they're a takeover target. And they're a takeover target for two reasons. One, their success and visibility, and that's when they will be investing in their new vehicle, this lower cost car that's higher volume, and that'll start to eat their cash alive.
Well, and a couple of things from yesterday's conference call regarding that. First of all, Musk says he predicts that by the end of by the very end of 2014, their annualized selling rate will be 40,000 globally. And he says we'll be selling 20,000 in the U.S. We'll have China. We'll have the EU. 40,000 units is conservative. Secondly, he complained a lot. He said our biggest problem is from the suppliers. We were talking about suppliers before. Well, he's a small company. What he needs, the reason he would need a takeover, someone like Toyota, is to have that part buying capacity. Now, the other interesting thing I wanted to mention from the little call-in yesterday when he had Wall Street analysts fawning over him and fawning over his car company during this phone conference, after they announced the $30.5 million quarterly loss, and the stock, by the way, was shooting up in after-hour prices from 133 or 34 to 150 some dollars. Is one analyst asked him what he thought of the BMW's new electric car?
Oh, he laughed.
He laughed. He said, "Well, I'm happy to see they're getting the electric car business. I hope they learn they can do better." And the two of them started laughing, both he and the analyst. Right about the same time, we had a call from our associate editor, David Zenly, who was in Marseille with a brief drive of the BMW i8, and he was telling Joe DiMaggio how much BMW was fawning over Tesla, saying that, boy, they did a good job with their electric cars. So,
well, the bottom line with the Tesla vehicle is that it works well. It's a real automobile.
Yeah.
The next car is going to be the challenge for them because it's a car that the battery technology is going to be probably the same as they have now. It's going to, if it's smaller and a little bit lighter, it can use less battery. But the cost to build that car is not appreciably less than building the car they're building now.
Right.
And therein lies the problem because the high profits coming from the high-end car.
Yeah, he also says he's confident they can have do the Model X with a 200-mile range and sell it.
The Model X is the crossover.
I'm sorry. The what is the new one? The new car, the cheaper car.
Yeah.
$35,000. Of course.
Well, they can't.
Of course, the Model S is a $55,000 car until you want the extended range version.
Which well, and there's another thing, too. If they're losing, how much did they lose last quarter?
$30.5 million.
How many cars did they build? Divide the amount by it, and you see the cost of the car. Okay?
Because Mark Rechtin pointed out in a tweet, if it hadn't been for the state and federal
credits,
they would have lost $100 million last quarter.
I understand.
But Peter, to your point about when does this become something other than a sideshow, and this gets back to the whole Traverse City thing, where people are scared to death at trying to reach 2025 CAFE. Okay, so what this is going to mean is that all automakers are going to have to do something besides internal combustion engines in a non-trivial way. And those that continue to make, internal combustion engine powered cars are going to have to use structural composites. They're going to have to use more aluminum. They're going to have to use more magnesium.
Which you have to do for good electric anyway to get the battery mass fraction where it should be.
And but I'm talking about for just normal cars and steel that costs a hell of a lot more than steel does
today.
But
that has to happen for electrics for electrics as well.
Right. I mean, it has to happen across the board.
You just define the new car. That's the new car. That's all.
Right. But I think, it's going to happen very incrementally. I think it's just going to be like the Prius, and that's why I mentioned the price of the Prius in 2004, the transaction prices. It'll be a small part of everybody's mix, Tesla aside, and as the costs come down and as it becomes a viable alternative for just a standard compact car.
You realize another reason why, if Tesla volume starts getting up higher and higher and higher, it makes them a bigger takeover target as well.
They will be taken over. It's going to be...
Think of the credits you can get by taking it over.
I would bet Toyota is going to grab them. But
that,
we'll see.
I would vote for that, too.
It's seamless.
What about Google?
Google.
Oh, no, why wouldn't they buy them?
Well,
They got all the money they need. They're in the phone business now, right?
They're in the phone business, and you know what? Their car program is a lot more than a lot of people think.
So, it's just like, why would it have to be a car company?
Yeah. So, let's move on. So, Nissan's plans to build more Leafs, and Fiat Chrysler won't invest any more in EVs until the market improves. Who's right?
They're both right. They're both right, because with the Leaf, you have a dedicated vehicle that you've built and a platform and a powertrain. You have got to get the volume up to get the piece cost down. Chrysler and Fiat have adapted a vehicle. For them, it's crazy to build more of those. So each one is right because of the direction they took to get into the EV business. Conversions are more problematic for a bunch of reasons, and the cars are more compromised from a mass standpoint usually. And truthfully, they're both right, but it's because one guy took the conservative approach that was arguably much safer. The other guys went out on a limb, and now they have to stay on that limb.
And Chrysler Fiat's just basically serving the California mandate, right?
Well, yeah, but so is Toyota with the RAV4 EV.
Sure.
So, was it an automobile where I saw this? I saw in one of the enthusiast publications that the Mercedes-Benz S-Class has stuff on it that the other automakers will get 10 years down the road in some cases. Do you believe that? Is Mercedes still that far in advance? I don't believe it either.
Now, there's another company that's got a lot of technology in the pipeline, not unlike what Mercedes has. It's just they've been very, very, very quiet about it.
And who would that be?
I don't remember.
And by the way,
the first thing they teach you. I don't remember.
I mean, Mercedes, I don't remember that maybe we did write that. But anyway.
I don't remember.
The S-Class. It will have luxury items that trickle down, and it's got a certain level of autonomy. And it's got the Continental stereo camera up in the
which they have in the E class already.
Yeah, exactly.
And there are other companies with stereo cameras that we'll see.
So that stuff will trickle down.
But I don't.
It might not take 10 years.
That's just it. My contention is it's not 10 years.
Five might be tops.
And there's a lot
of three for a lot of it.
Well, five when it gets to the very low end,
And there's a lot of the technology that's in that car that is not coming to North America because it's due to regulations.
Well,
like
and vice versa. The guys at Mercedes believe that autonomy is more logical to happen in the States before it happens in Europe.
Right, but these are more even simple things like the headlights that they have on that car. So this is the first car that's all LED. There's no single light
inside
bulb.
Inside and outside, yeah.
No single light bulb. But the thing of it is that so you can drive with your brights on the entire time, and then the car sees if a car is coming at you. And what it does is it so for the driver who is coming at the Mercedes, the headlamp automatically blanks out its brights in that area. That's not legal here. They'll have that in Europe. They've got a light braking system in the back, whereby it's if a collision is imminent, it autonomously starts blinking the lights.
Porsche has had that too,
like mad.
Some other companies
you can't do that. You can't do that here.
Several companies do it. And
right,
it's just,
but
Europe.
So there's a lot of stuff like that. I drove that car and it was just like, it's nice. It's got a lot of technology, but I don't know that I felt like I was. With the Jetsons.
None of us would be upset if the hot stone massage made it into the Chevy Cruze, the next Chevy
Cruze.
There's
a lot of that stuff.
You can't build a brand on technology alone. Just cannot do it. And I'm seeing these car companies go in that direction because
it's been Acura's, basically, their hallmark for what they've been talking about for the longest time in their marketing.
And whereas they didn't know what else to do.
I understand, but the point is, technology, one, is not a luxury feature.
And where has that gotten Acura exactly?
Built for mankind.
Got them a new agency.
Yeah.
Well, I've got a new NSX.
Yeah, fire the agency.
A new,
don't
very
have any
cool
ideas.
Technology NSX.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you probably won't like it. You would rather it had a manual transmission, and you'd get a hair shirt to drive with it.
I don't see manual transmissions as hair shirts.
The lace around his...
Yeah. Yeah, and anti-power steering. I drove a car that had columnless electric power steering recently. And the company that developed it, company...
In your living room?
No.
Racing game?
They have it with like 12 presets they did for it just to show how flexible they can make it feel. All right? One of them was 1966 911.
Huh. Really?
And it felt like it. It was like... And the guy says, now we'll try this. It was unbloody believable. And then one was, remember when you first got into the Accord with the super light power steering at low speed and you turned it and the wheel just went, they have one like that.
Wow.
Or a 62 Cadillac.
Well, the 62 Cadillac I love because it was, you could do it with your little finger, and there were literally dozens of easy turns lock to lock.
Okay, now we're...
Remember those knobs that people used to put?
Necker knobs.
Necker knobs.
Illegal in California because you could be disemboweled on it or something.
Yeah. Before we talk about the best sports car designs currently, which everyone's waiting for, I should mention a friend of mine, Peter Brock. Now, Peter's a famous guy. At age, was he 18 or 19? 19. He went to work for GM Styling at the time, and Peter Brock was there at the beginning of the Stingray. Now, the first Stingray was the Stingray Racer, and Peter was involved with that, and then eventually he left General Motors, and he became famous for the designer of the Cobra Daytona Coupe for Carroll Shelby. And then he became a racing team owner and blah, blah, blah. Well, Peter's still around, and he has come out with a new book called Corvette Stingray, The Genesis of an American Icon. There's Peter there with the book. He just sent me a copy today, and I was thrilled to get it because that's my all-time favorite car.
Explain. This is not the 63 Stingray.
No.
This is the car that set the design theme for the 63 Stingray. Yeah.
This is the original, what I call the original Stingray, which to me is still my favorite car. I don't care about the aero problems or anything. It's just the most stunning car in person. And the first thing Ed Welburn did when he took over GM, and enthusiasts should be internally grateful to him forever for this, he commissioned, there's Peter Brock's early illustration of the concept of the Stingray. But Ed Welburn had the original Stingray restored.
And retrofitted, because it had been kind of morphed by Mitchell over the years.
Retrofitted it back to when it was stopped racing and Mitchell just painted it.
When they painted it silver. Yeah. But they weren't ballsy enough to do it the original red.
Yeah. Now, I've rode in the original Stingray several times with Mitchell driving. And when you see it today, and you see the size of today's sports cars, and you see the original Stingray, your jaw drops because the thing is taut and compact, and it's a thrilling car. Now, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the best sports cars today, currently.
Design.
Design, our favorites. But before that, we're going to hear from our friends at Hyundai and another mention of the Dream Cruise.
What's my type? Well, they have to be smart, a good sense of direction, good taste in music, and, of course, good looks with nice curves. That gets my temperature rising every time we touch. And that exotic name, Elantra. Wait, are we talking about cars?
Whether it's on television, online, or through social media, AutoLine knows how to effectively get your marketing message to the people you want to reach. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
I got that wrong. That was an AutoLine Empire promo, not Woodward Dream Cruise. So, we're going to talk about... I was going to talk about Don Butler from Cadillac, who just left suddenly. There's really not too much to say about it. He was unhappy with the direction. He was one of the true believers for Cadillac, and he abruptly resigned this week because Dan Ackerson brought someone else that Dan, on a whim, decided, I want him to run Cadillac. And so Don Butler stayed for a while, but he finally had had enough. So I guess we can move on about that. So, gentlemen, which are the best sports car designs currently? Todd?
I was going to say ask Jim. He's got a big smile.
You go first. Come on.
Jim will go.
No, go Jim.
I am still, every time I see one, it's spectacular and it works as a car, Audi R8. It has a package that holds real people. It has luggage space. It's mid-engine, which in a mid-engine car, luggage space is tough. And you can, if you wanted, and you put snow tires on it, you live back here, you can drive it every day, even though you will be plowing your street if you live in a small village or something. But that, to me, is still one of, and it looks as good now as it did when it came out. And when you see one go by, they're just as head-turning. It is a phenomenally competent piece of design that is beautiful and technical at the same time.
Yeah, I had a black V8, all right, which is my favorite. The V10's cool, but I like the R8 V8. I had one for a week, and all I could think of is this could have been a mid-engine Corvette. But it's a spectacular car. It's really good. One of the great designs right now.
I agree with you that the V8 is kind of the right engine for that car.
See, I prefer the V10, but the V8's the prettier car. It has the side blades that just follow the contour of the car. They didn't notch them for extra air. That's a V10 that the guys are seeing now. And the other thing with the V10, it had a lot more openings in the rear body and so on in the front. But the V10, I just love the noise it makes.
Well, plus the V8 I had was a 6-speed, which I preferred.
The new car has a dual-clutch 7-speed. That is absolutely spectacular.
See, Peter's okay with hair shirts as well, apparently.
Oh, manual transmissions. You guys are Luddites.
Yeah. Well, I'll go ahead.
What about the transmission they had in that car, though?
That was awful.
It's not my absolute favorite by any means, but just one that really intrigues me, and it will be controversial, at least with Jim. I admit it's not the loveliest-looking car out there, but it's very intriguing in that it has this kind of taut body work. It's mid-engine. It's not out yet, but we've seen it plenty, and that's the Alfa 4C. I'm very interested in that car.
And you've seen it in person.
I've seen it in
which
person.
Which does make a difference, I've been told.
Yes.
The problem I have with it is the faux homage to the Tipo 33 Stradale. It's like, come on, it's just contrived. But when I see one in person, I'll decide.
I'd have to say, since it's the 50th anniversary, it's got to be a 911. It's just.
That was on my list. I mean, I'm a 911 guy.
The 911, to me, is a much more successful design than the superior Porsche sports car, the Cayman.
Yeah. Agreed.
I do like the redesign of the new Cayman.
The Cayman, to me, in the redesign, though, it got a little bit more stiffer and boxier in some parts. It lost some of the voluptuousness the first one had, but it's more distinctive from the 911 than the previous one was.
Right. The new 9/11 looks great.
Oh.
What's jarring to you if you're a 9/11 person?
That's the 50th, which is the coolest one anyway.
That's the one, it is. Jim, that's the one. Saw that up in Trevor.
That is the coolest, by the way. The jarring thing about the 9/11, if you're a 9/11 person, is how big it is. And, I mean, you get over that real quick because it drives great. I had a 9/11 for a while, the new one with the PDK, and when you hammered the PDK 9/11, it was fabulous. You could pretend you're entering, leaving the pits at Le Mans, and it's all good. Except day to day, I missed the manual gearbox in the 9/11 because it kept. I kept saying to myself, "Well, you know, it just didn't feel like a 9/11 to me." But I'm an old school 9/11 guy. But the new 9/11, even though it's big, it's pretty spectacular.
Yeah, I borrowed it.
And from a design standpoint, they've made it so it's modern, but it is a 9/11.
Right.
I mean, they've done a phenomenal job on the design to me. That it's exactly what it's supposed to be, but it's beautiful.
And yeah. And it's big because everything is big now compared with certainly 50 years ago.
Oh, they didn't build the 9/11 to crash. They built it to drive.
And it doesn't have a manual because they need fuel efficiency.
Yeah, and I get it. It was jarring to me when Porsche did the big 50th media release, and we put these pictures on the website. But they pictured the new car with the original several angles, and it was like, it just freaked you out because it was almost half again as big. And I forget where I was, and I saw someone who had a beautiful, like a 72 911S, and it was lowered and this and that. And I walked up and I said, man, you forget.
It was a tiny car.
How small they were. But anyway, yeah, the new 911 is a favorite. It's hard to argue with the 458 Italia, the Ferrari. I mean, it's still stunning. You never get used to seeing them on the road because they look great. Yeah. Now, that's a big...
It's good enough for my telephone.
Yeah, if it's good enough for Jim's phone. I'll have to take my hat off to the GM boys. I do like the Stingray, but the Roadster... I don't like the roof. I don't like the homage to the Nissan.
The inadvertent homage.
Yeah, GTR. I just thought that was unfortunate. I think they out-tricked themselves, but the Roadster convertible, I think, looks fabulous.
I've been surprised. The hardtop doesn't bother me as much as it bothers you, but what do you think? What about the tail lamps? That was very controversial. At least
yeah, I mean, show. You know, I don't care for them, but... You know, on the Roadster, it doesn't bother me as much.
Yeah.
Actually, if that thing had round taillights on the coupe, you'd think even more of the Skyline, the GTR.
Exactly. You're right.
I suppose I'm trying to put, you know, a little bit of frosting on it somewhere.
I'm surprised at how many Corvettes I've seen driving around town.
The new ones.
Yeah, the new ones.
Captive fleets I've seen, yellow.
Have you seen the dark green that's almost black?
Yes.
Oh, is it a good color?
Yeah, that's a good color. And I've seen a darkish red. It wasn't a bright red. I just can't. I don't like yellow. So, I mean,
we were supposed to get a yellow one for the cover. I brought that cover last time I was here, and then we got the blue one at the last minute, and the blue was pretty nice. And I was fortunate enough to drive that car when we did the photo shoot at Gingerman, and both on and off the track, and it's very impressive. I mean, it's...
Well, I'm glad for them, because they worked hard on it, and it should be a good car.
Yep.
I mean, they listened to...
From a handling point of view, they finally got it right.
I mean, they listened to the critics, and they got tired of it, and they, you know, they were determined to deliver, and they did, and I'm happy for them, because... You know,
there's a Skyline. Oh no, I'm sorry. That's
those men and women who worked on this. I mean, they worked their asses off, and you know, they should be proud of the car. Now the drive is next week in California, so
I think you'll enjoy it.
I'm not invited.
Jim, I have a question for you, like with regard to that and other cars, and you know, thinking about sports cars, and you know, in many ways, sports cars are impractical cars, right? I mean, by their nature, they're...
A sedan will always be more practical.
Right.
It doesn't mean they're impractical, but there were other cars that are more practical.
But what I wonder about is that should sports car design be sensuous and voluptuous, or should it be brutal, folded metal, hard edges? I mean,
there's room for both.
But does one say, okay, I'm completely and utterly
impractical? The voluptuous car can look as impractical as the harshed edge car. They can both look equally impractical.
Look at the Aston Martins.
Yeah, exactly. You asked about another. I'll give you another car that's controversial, and it's the second car from this car company. The first car I thought was like a circus wagon. It was badly proportioned, incompetently surfaced, and the car they've got out now to me is one of those things that when you see it in the tin, it's striking, and it's the Pagani Huayra. In person, it's just, oh my God. And if you ever get a chance to get up behind it or see it from on top, I looked down on it the first time I saw it. In plan view, it's bloody spectacular. And it also apparently it's the product of a company where everybody in there is just so obsessive about what their cars are that I expected it to be even worse styled when I heard about it. It was under development as the C9. And they actually, it's very, very, it's impressive.
Hmm. Gary, I think it gets back to what I've said before about the Mazda Miata versus the Kappa GMs that came and went very quickly, that the Pontiac Solstice was designed from the outside in. You know, Bob Lutz wanted to design first. Very voluptuous, good-looking car, designed from the outside in, didn't handle all that well, and had no place to put anything inside. Talk about practicality, or outside in the trunk. There was no trunk space. Mazda Miata designed the Colin Chapman way, basically from the inside out. We need, you know, an engine here, two seats, rear drive, and then wrap some sheet metal around it, and it's worked, mm-hmm. I think.
So, Todd, that's the last word, because now we're going to go to rapid fire. Ben, roll that thing. Okay. RMT-1 asks, since Fiat made that Alfa Romeo Spider / Mazda Miata deal, could SRT get use of this platform for use in a Mini Viper sports car, similar to the 2000 Dodge Demon concept? Well, a lot of things could happen.
Why would they?
Yeah.
Well, they could do it, but they could, theoretically, they could. No, you know what? They probably can't. I'll tell you why. It's probably obviated by the nature of the agreement that it's with Fiat, not with Chrysler.
Right.
They'd have to basically go and renegotiate it.
And unfortunately, considering how many of those cars are being sold worldwide, there'd be no reason to do it. That's why Volkswagen can't get off the mark with the, what's it called, the Blue Sport.
But that's a vehicle that probably should never go in production.
Alexander asked the panel, do we think Honda will build a flagship car to compete with the Impala?
Oh, in other words, an Avalon, basically.
Yeah.
A Honda Avalon.
Seems every mainstream automaker is taking this segment seriously again.
You'd say that's what the TL is.
The TL is no bigger than really the new Accord. Yeah. Not much. I just got out of an RLX, and it's not the RLX because the RLX is 60 grand. In some ways, it is the antithesis of what Honda does well. You know, the Accord worked best when it was an Accord-sized car. The last Accord, they let it get too big. So, now. Nah.
And there's a new Maxima coming from Nissan, apparently, and that's all the cars you need in that segment, and then some, really.
Eric Ambrose asks, what price does true luxury start? $100,000? That's what he said.
True luxury, to me, isn't about price. It's about what the car is. And true luxury cars are cars that when you drive them, there is a sense of occasion about what you do when you drive the car. And as a result, you could have a true luxury car that could cost 60 grand if there was something about it that was magic and special. It's the opportunity that Ford had with the MKZ, and they didn't understand it. They had no idea. And because they, like most of the other companies, are checkbox luxury.
Yeah.
It's how a car does stuff. The problem is that the cars that do that predominantly do what I've just described, are all very expensive cars because these are the last companies on earth that remember this kind of stuff.
Chuck Grancy is asking me, should Tony Stewart resume racing multiple racing venues after he recuperates from broke both his two places in his leg in a sprint car crash? Chuck Grancy says yes. You know, Tony Stewart is the modern embodiment of A.J. Foyt.
In a lot of ways, yeah.
In a lot of ways, he can drive everything. He's got that attitude. He's a throwback, and everyone really loves Tony. The problem is, Chuck, is that if it was just Tony and a few buddies racing during the week, It's great, but you know, Stuart Haas Racing has over 100 people who depend on.
It's the racing business issue.
Yeah, it's the business issue that Tony confronts every day, and you know, it's bigger than him now. So he has to make a choice. I mean, he has all these people depending on him being there, and it's rough for them. So he's going to have some soul searching. I don't have an answer. I love to see Tony run. As his crew chief said, you know, he doesn't golf. He, you know, for relaxation, he goes and runs sprint cars. But he said, you know, it affects us all, so we'll see. I have a question for Gary, Carl says. Recently, you mentioned that you drove the next generation Volkswagen GTI. Can you give a brief comparison to the current?
I drove the GTD,
diesel-powered
one. So
that's not the same.
Not the same.
Never mind.
Would you buy one?
Absolutely.
Would you?
The diesel one?
Yeah.
If you had a choice between that and a GTI, which would you choose?
Diesel one.
Buck W65 says the Nissan 370Z is the best sports car. It does everything a sports car is supposed to do at an affordable price. Do you guys agree?
It looks fat. Sports cars, to me, one of the things they're supposed to do is look muscular and lithe. That's what sports cars are about. There was a car that was called a sports car that didn't look that way. The first TT did not look that way, but it was such a radical car. It was a design statement, not a sports car. Sports cars are supposed to communicate the fact that I am nimble, that I'm agile, and that's something the 370 doesn't do, the 350 didn't do. The last Z that did it was the previous generation 300ZX that was, to me, an attractive car, almost too pretty, but it looked like it was agile.
I like it. I don't love it.
Too rounded, then.
The current car is doughy and puffy.
Right. Well,
it's like the Solstice is the same thing. The Solstice looked like it had the mumps.
The current car, to me, looks like it's just they were trying so hard, and they really didn't have anything inside. They were just trying to do something that they could get someone's attention with. I don't really care for it. Rum and Coke asks, will the Cadillac ELR sell? It sure looks cool. I think the ELR has a real shot in the touchy-feely enclaves because it does look cool.
And they have modest expectations in that this is going to be an expensive and, by design, an exclusive automobile. So success for them is different from what other people think. And I think it's something that could help change the Cadillac image to a lot of people.
Yeah, that's success for that car. If they have a few people getting out of it, driving up to the Oscars.
One of our neighbors had one home. He works for General Motors. Black. It was spectacular. Even uncamouflaged but debadged and everything. It was like, wow.
The car they should call the Eldorado.
It should be the Eldorado. Absolutely.
I don't think it'll be a success.
But what's a success? You mean they won't sell any?
They've got all that Volt technology they got to do something with.
So they won't sell any?
They'll sell lots of them. They got to move metal. They got to move those batteries that they're making.
So why isn't it a success?
Because it will not be this certain level of exclusivity that one should achieve.
Luxury is not
going to be unsuccessful because they'll sell too many of them?
Exactly.
So let's see. Let me get this straight then. Then an E-Class.
The democratization of everything is to...
An E-Class, they sell how many per year?
Yeah, but it has the same engine as an S-Class, so it diminishes the value of the S-Class. No, it has the same engine as a C-Class, so really the C-Class diminishes it. Come on.
Scotty in Cleveland wants to know, we haven't heard much about the Code 130R concept. Is the car going to happen? Is it under development?
On again, off again.
Yeah, yep. Off right
now. Right now, off. Yep.
Pierre Cardin, AMX, asks, why are Corvette Roadsters now called Stingray? I thought Stingray referred to the hardtops roof. No.
Nope.
They're all called Stingray.
Starting in?
2014.
Yep. And before that, starting in?
63.
And Ed Welburn and the boys and girls brought the name back for 2014. Do I agree with it? No, but that's okay. That's just me.
Well, it was two words for a while there, I think.
It was two words until 68.
68, yeah. Yes.
And it's interesting because it looks like there'll be a Corvette that won't be a Stingray at some time in the future.
Well, that makes sense. Expand that brand. Why not? What?
Manta Ray.
Ooh.
Yeah. Mitch W. asks, would Jim Hall tell us which manufacturers are best at working their designs around government mandates like those awful high hoods?
There's an argument that Audi's doing a pretty darn good job because they can play around with how they're doing the grille. And Audi, remember, a lot of their cars have the engine in ramming position because it still is a lot of it's ahead of the front axle center line. So I think Audi does a good job. BMWs are getting a little odd. They're getting kind of pig nosy as the front end comes up. Mercedes seems to do a good job, except that new S-Class, the grille is so bloody big. But, you know, that's what Mercedes is known for. So I guess you just take all the things
yeah,
that are...
Yeah, it's an S-Class. It's the way it's supposed to look.
Except, no, not like this. That grille is out of scale for the rest of the car. It really is.
Yeah, it has been before.
Have you seen it in the 10 yet?
Yes, I was there in Hamburg for the
For that one.
Introduction, anyway.
All right, S10 Baja wants to know, what about the upcoming Colorado Canyon? What is your take on what we will see in terms of engines, diesel, styling differentiation? The only thing I know is that the Colorado is going to be a sporty truck, and the GMC is going to be more of a...
Professional grade.
Yeah.
It's going to have technology, in other words, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The fives aren't going to be in it. The fives are gone.
Yeah.
Apparently, the diesel is under consideration for life cycle.
Four cylinders.
Yeah.
You know, what's that going to compete with? I mean, Toyota Tacoma, obviously, the numbers are not going to be big. In the truck world, it's irrelevant, I think. The numbers.
Olds 442 has Buick Encore sales surprised you, anyone? I saw they were stronger than expected.
Surprised me. I couldn't imagine that many people want to drive a giant sheet metal tuber.
No, what will surprise me is if those numbers stick through after a year.
I was surprised initially. I had one. You know, I realized what people are buying, you know, because it's got a lot of stuff on it.
Interior is very, very, very nice.
Yeah, and you're right. Will they be able to sustain it?
If you call it a small, tall, premium hatchback a crossover, I guess you can sell it for a period of time at least.
Okay.
They only sold 15,428 this year, so it's not like they're...
Yeah, but how long has it been on sale, Gary?
It's only been on sale for about...
2.5-3 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not doing badly.
No, it's not doing badly at all.
Okay. I think I've got everything unless... Oh, yeah. I just see. These weren't showing up, Ben. Let's get a couple phone calls now. Back to back.
Hi, it's Jason Armstrong calling from Calgary, Canada. Just real quick, I just wanted to just kind of comment. Where do you think the sports car is going to be going? The digital age... speed cameras, plugging into the computers, monitoring the speed that way through GPS, insurance companies being able to give breaks for people using these devices and those kinds of things. Is the younger generation really not interested? Tracks going broke. What do you think the future is for the sports car?
Okay. I think for a lot of people who buy sports cars, the future is going to be track days.
It'll be track days for some. For others, it's a car that you can go and have fun with. But fun, I mean, a Miata is a good example of a serious sports car.
Yes.
It does not have performance that you'll lose your license over for driving it just down the street and revving it up. And it's a blast to drive. I have yet to drive a Miata except first-generation automatic where I didn't get out of it and I haven't been grinning ear to ear. So there's sports cars, and then there are high-performance sports cars. High-performance sports cars are more problematic. But it's rare to even find a case where you can drive one of those cars near their limit.
I hate to say it, but I think to a certain extent the Miata is more problematic because the great thing for me in the Miata is that you can't clutter up the dashboard with too much stuff, okay? It's still about driving the car, not, you know, what you listen to or who you call while you're in the car.
So you don't listen to the radio when you're in the car?
I do. I said it's not about what you... I don't need, you know, Pandora and a bunch of other things.
He's a Luddite. He rejects the new technology.
I am when it comes to sports cars, I guess.
Ben, one more call.
Hi, guys. This is Youngblood, Cleveland, Ohio, calling. In the September issue of Road and Track, they're reporting that the 2016 Mustang GT350 will have a special V8 in it, naturally aspirated, about 5.4 liters. But the kicker is they're saying that it's going to have a Ferrari-style flat plane crankshaft, which will allow it to rev over 7,000 RPMs and produce close to 600 horsepower. Fact, fiction, thoughts? Good show. Later. Bye.
Something like that.
You don't need a flat plane crank to rev an engine that high if you've got... The bigger problem is basically the reciprocating mass in the valve train. Those are bigger problems. But flat plane, you get them by mail and they never fit. Flat plane crank V8s are pretty neat because they make a different sound.
Right. You know what?
Is that it?
We've come to the end of the road. It's time to put the campfire out, boys and girls. And we're going to hit the road. Don't forget, we will not be here next Thursday because Johnny and company are going to be live at the Woodward Dream Cruise at 4 o'clock on Friday, August 16th. So don't look for us next Thursday. Look for John and company next Friday
at
4 p.m. And I'd like to thank our guests today, Todd. Thanks, Todd Lawson from Automobile.
It went so quickly, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Gary Vasilash from Automobile Design and Production, Automotive Design and Production, and Jim Hall, 2953 Analytics. Jim, it's always a pleasure to see you.
Pleasure as always, Peter.
And you can see my stuff at AutoExtremist.com. I'm on Twitter, but I'm /PeterMDLorenzo. And Facebook, there is a Facebook Auto Extremist, but, you know, I'm only briefly there once in a while. You can friend Autoline at Facebook.com/AutolineNetwork. And you can follow Autoline on Twitter at Twitter.com/Autoline. And we really appreciate you coming by, and thanks for joining us. And we'll see you, some of you, next Friday.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by the 2013 Hyundai Elantra. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
Visit our website, Autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at Autoline.tv.